June 28th, 2020. So, how was your Father's Day? Did you get out? Did you stay in? Me, smoked chicken was great. Too much, as a matter of fact, turned it into soup on Friday. Fam chipped in and got me a wireless Sonos speaker. Had some drinks and some tunes. Good time. Okay, I miss getting fountain soda from the gas station and hot dogs. I used to be good for one, maybe two 44-ounces a day. A couple times a week, a hot dog, a QT, or 7-Eleven. Speaking of 7-Eleven, gone in 5 years. Everything is convenient now. We'll move on. Time to stop talking about getting back to normal. It's not going to happen. Don't misunderstand. Fun is coming back. But take schooling as an example. Stop trying to tweak college classrooms. They are and forever will be gone based on the past. Classes should go on shifts with less attending. No more 250 people taking Radio TV 101 at the same time. Fun online classes you don't get credit for should be added to the stuff you gotta take to condition the students. The statement, you learn less online, is not an excuse to not do it. Come on, smart people, figure this one out. Okay, three things you should if you have not. Gus's pretzels in the air fryer. Man, do they taste better in the fryer than when you cook them in the oven. If you don't have a fryer, go get one. About $50 should do the trick. French fries, toasted Ravs, crab rangoon, and Gus's pretzels, all better. Go to Aldi's, get some German mustard to go with. Number two, I don't think you can call this a documentary, but on Prime I found drive-in movie ads by Sprocket Films. Classic drive-in ads they used to play with the COVID revival of drive-ins. Maybe this is something you want to look into. Here's what I saw. Here's what caught my eye from these ads that were in the 50s and 60s. Number one, there was no PG. It was G, M, R, and X. M was for mature, parental guidance suggested. Now, PG. The ads were mainly about going to the concession stand and how much time you had before the movie started. You know, you've got 5 minutes. You've only got 4 minutes before the movie starts. Hurry up and get to the concession stand. In the ads, it was almost all Pepsi products. No Coke, especially Dr. Pepper. No ketchup on hot dogs, mustard, and relish in the ads. They had heaters you would put on your car windows, umbrella-like contraptions to put on your windshield, and God help you if you got caught stealing a speaker. $50. Carbon monoxide was a big concern. Don't fall asleep ads all over the place. And oh, for all you love bugs out there, PDA was not tolerated, which I kind of thought defeated the point. Lastly, in almost every reel, there was an ad promoting going to your neighborhood church. Not Catholic, not Lutheran, not Protestant, just church. No idea who paid for it. Lastly, get ready for your Stanley Cup St. Louis Blues. The league is targeting July 10th as the start of training camp with possible games in August. I'm not a betting man, but I'm 50-50 they make it through the season, and that's for all leagues. But enough of the doom and the gloom, Jim Thomas is in the house. If you like Mizzou, Rams, or Blues, this talk has something for you. So much so that we went a little long. So if you want to, feel free to start it, and we do a pretty good job of stopping with Mizzou and going to Rams, and then stopping with the Rams and going to Blues. It's worth the wait. Jim's a pro like Vigagorian, Dan O'Neill, Rob Rains before him. I've known him for a long time, and we use the podcast as an excuse to catch up. If you wouldn't mind, subscribe, write a review, tell a friend. We've got some great episodes lined up with the likes of Art Holiday, Guy Phillips, Ray Hartman. Starting to pick up a little steam when it comes to the guests, so let's do the same with our audience, and thank you for your help. Bada bing, bada boom. Hear how easy and fun it is to have a conversation with St. Louis Post-Dispatch, St. Louis Blues beat writer, Jim Thomas.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
And welcome back to the next edition of Overtime with Oliver. We are honored today to have our guest Jim Thomas, Blues beat writer for the St. Louis Blues. Been the beat writer since August of 2017.
Seems like only yesterday. Well, it was almost yesterday. You know, I know just enough now, David. It's great to be on your show here. I know just enough to be dangerous now about this game of hockey.
So. Yeah, I'm going to blame you for waiting so long to take the job. We could have some more cups if you had switched earlier.
You know, when I originally joined the beat, 17-18, I was thought of as the jinx. Because the Blues missed what? For the first time in 7 years, I think? Missed the playoffs by a point. All those Rams teams were bad, at least the last 10 years. The Rams have this Blues have this tremendous offseason. O'Reilly, Perron comes, Pat Maroon, Mozak. And they're crummy, right? The first half of the season. Doug Armstrong even said, boy, maybe what I hear is right about you. You are a jinx. Well, now I'm like the good luck charm. Because it took 20 years for lightning to strike twice between the 99 Rams and the 2019 Blues. But one of our editors after that said, we got to get you back on the Mizzou beat so we can get them a national football. And I'm like, yeah, oh, yeah, right. Like, Mizzou's going to win a national championship in football. But
I struggled with what to wear. So I wasn't going to go Rams. Thought about Mizzou, but I'm talking to Norm later next week. So I figured I'd do some props, and I wear my blue stuff.
There you go. There you go. I love it. The blue note. Repping the blue note, yeah.
Jim, how many years have you been writing professionally?
Since 1980 as a full-time writer with the Post. Now, before that, I was finishing up school. I was on the 7.5-year plan. Finished that UMSL, but I was working as a clerk at the Post-Dispatch from like 76 on. I was stringing. They had a St. Charles Post edition. It just covered the St. Charles news, and it covered then I think it was just 7 high schools in St. Charles County. Now there's about 37. I mean, there was only one Wentzville back then, one Howell, Francis Howell, one Fort Tumult. And I would string, and I'd like in the football season, I'd cover a game and get like $25 for it. So I started doing that maybe around, I don't know, 77, 78. Steve Wade, there was only one full-time employee. Steve Wade now, he's traveled all over the world writing for the AP. He's now in Tokyo writing a lot about the Olympics that are now not going to happen. But yeah, but as a full-time Post-Dispatch writer since 1980. You remember 1980, don't you?
I digged up a 1983 story you did on Fort Zumwalt and Pattonville girls basketball.
I remember it well, early in the third quarter. No, I don't remember anything about it.
When did the Suburban Journals close? I don't remember.
No, it wasn't the Suburban Journals. This was the St. Charles Post. If you subscribe to the Post-Dispatch in St. Charles County, it was like maybe an 8 or 10, 12-page wraparound. You'd get it around your regular Post-Dispatch. So, yeah, it had nothing to do with the Suburban Journals. And it would be 5 days a week you would get the wraparound. Like Saturday and Sunday, there was no St. Charles edition of your Post-Dispatch. But it was a lot of fun.
I liked reporting on high school sports.
I still love the high school sports. I try to follow some of our stuff we do a great job, I think, covering the prep sports. A lot of very talented writers, and actually Steve Overby, who's one of our high school writers back in the St. Charles Post days, in maybe it was around 81 or 82, I had replaced Steve Wade as the one full-time employee, but you had a budget for stringers, the guys that would just cover maybe a couple high school games a week. And Steve worked for me then. So we go way back to 1982. Some of my favorite high school moments sports writing moments were high school. I remember one of the best football games I ever covered was a Melville against St. Louis U High at Melville. I think it might have been 1991, maybe 92. It was a state semifinal for the right to go to the Show Me Bowl then in Columbia. And Gary Kornfeld, like every maybe 5 or 10 years, I would bump into him or have some reason to give him a call. And I would always kid, you know, that was a great game. It was one of the best games that I'd ever covered. That Melville had Daryl Major. He went on to Mizzou. They had a couple other D1 guys. Slew had, forget the guy's name, a quarterback that I think went to Northwestern. I believe Jason Dulick was a wide receiver on the team that went to Illinois, and it was like 14-12 was the score. Just a real defensive struggle. The week before that, I'd covered, and this was at a time when I was kind of in between covering Mizzou and before the Rams came here. So I was covering some like the early expansion meetings to try to get the St. Louis Stallions and all that, but I'd cover a high school game. I did a lot of like college games where maybe I'd try to cover a college game on Saturday and in the same area, occasionally in the same town, would cover an NFL game the next day. I think I covered like 40 football games at your college or professional, or in this case, SLU and Melville. The week before the SLU Melville, I was covering Miami and Florida State. Like down at the Orange Bowl, you know, and back then the rivalry was tremendous, but the SLU Melville game was better overall. It was just a very entertaining game.
So you've been at the Post a while. Got any good Bob Bregg stories?
Well, Bob was always very good to me and very supportive. And I have an older brother who just until maybe, 5 years ago, retired from the Post, named Stefan. And he wrote, did the Agate page. And we put the stuff there. I did some freelance photography for us. Also answered the phones and stuff. Anyway, Bob Bragg used to call, since he was older, he called him Big Poison and I was Little Poison. But he was great. Bob Bragg was great and an institution. I would put him on the Mount Rushmore of St. Louis sports writers, and along with Bob Burns, Bernie Miklas. I'm not sure who the fourth is. Maybe in 20 years it'll be Ben Fredrickson.
Maybe it's Jim Thomas.
No. It would have to be like, I think, columnist types, you know, that had a little more influence on the.
So did you grow up reading Bragg?
Bragg? Oh, certainly. And Bob Burns, a guy I really admired, was Dave Doerr. Mm. And he covered Olympics. He covered Mizzou basketball, Illinois basketball, Final Four. And Dave had he just had a real energy and a jump to his stories. And he was a guy that I really, really admired reading his stuff. And he retired. He's still in the St. Louis area, but covered a bunch of Olympics too. Was like the chronicler of Jackie Joyner Kersee, you know, when she was doing her thing.
What did your folks do?
My dad worked at Monsanto downtown, was a maintenance guy. And my mom, with five kids, she was a housewife. Good sports fan too.
No writers in the background?
No, and I have three boys, and I guess they didn't think what I was doing was fun, so none of them are writers. So no writers, but I always it was kind of in my blood. I delivered papers at a very young age, back when the Post-Dispatch Daily cost 7 cents for the daily paper. I'd get a penny and a half for each one I sold, and then the weekend paper was 25 cents, and I think we got like maybe 5 cents or something for that. But I always, even to this day, and I subscribe, I do get a discount as a Post-Dispatch employee, but I subscribe. I love the smell of the ink of the newsprint. So, and when I was little, maybe 10 years old, I did like a couple times, like a little neighborhood sports section. I don't know what I wrote about. But as I got older, I grew up in the Watergate era. And on my 7.5 year plan, I was at George Washington University for 2 years in Washington, D.C., right at the height of Watergate. We're talking, I was there from 72 to 74. That's what I wanted to be, Woodward and Bernstein. And I was actually a political science major. I did not have a journalism degree, but I ended up, but I always loved sports, of course. I ended up covering sports.
Do you remember the first article you ever wrote that got printed?
No, I would say it had to be one of those St. Charles Post football games. I remember... I covered a St. Charles West football game. Jim Williams and Steve Stahl, they were, you know, heated rivals and longtime coach. Steve Stahl is still alive. I haven't heard from him in a while, but he would send me an email, you know, every once in a while. I think Jim Williams has passed away, been gone for a while. But I remember it was one of the early stories. I remember writing it, and then to my surprise, the main Post-Dispatch picked it up, and it was on the front of the Saturday sports section. That was a big surprise. Back then we had a very tiny Saturday paper. It was only like 14 pages or something. It was very, very tiny, but we had a little bit of a sports section there, and there it was. So that's about the earliest one I remember.
You're going to laugh. My first one was for the Maneater, and it was on Robert Delpino.
Robert Delpino, who once made the all Italian American team. And maybe Robert Delpino did have some, you know, Italian ancestry. I don't know, but I think it probably was a mistake. They just looked at the last name. Turned out, you know, he did a little bit in the National Football League. I think he might have played for the LA Rams.
I think he did. Yeah. All right, backstory before we go to the writing career. When did you meet your wife? I could not find it online.
You couldn't. That's because we met at about 5 a.m. at Pop's over there in Sauget in 1982. I actually met her the same year I met the writing friend, and still a lifelong friend. I talked to him today, Steve Overby. Met them both in 1982. I was working nights. That's when I was running the St. Charles Post. I was the one-person sports staff, full-timer, with this I don't know, $300 a week budget for stringers to go out and help cover all the games. And so we worked nights. A lot of times I wouldn't get home till because we were it was an afternoon paper then, the Post-Dispatch was. And so the St. Charles Post stuff, we'd be writing 2, 3, 4 in the morning. So I never went to bed early. So this was like a Saturday night, and there she was.
How did you propose?
How did I propose? It was at Oz, the bar that was next to the and on the knee and everything. And it wasn't very romantic because before I did that, I said, hey, I have vacation next week. You want to go get married and go down to Florida? So that's kind of what happened. But yeah, I was living with her within a month, and we were married in 6 months, and now it's 37 years later. She's going nuts over the quarantine at home, you know, stay at home. She's getting, I think that's been the key to my marriage, is I've been on the road a lot, or even in football where there's only one game a week, you'd be out at Rams Park till 8, 9 o'clock. So she, I don't know if I should say this, but she joined the NHL's return to play committee. She's trying to get the games going so I can get out of the house.
How many kids you got, man?
I have three kids, 24, 20, soon to be 30, and 32. So three boys.
Take your time with this. You have two children who have graduated from West Point.
Mm-hmm.
Walk me through the process on how that comes to be, where it came from, and how you landed where you landed, because that's a unique story.
Well, we the one that's 32, the first one to go, his name is Tim. He was always like into the military and reading military books, and I'm talking about like he's like maybe 11, and he's reading. It wasn't like a book. Here's a book on the Civil War or General Grant. He was reading a book about Israeli tanks, pretty specialized stuff, I would think. And at that young age, he's like, you know, most kids, oh, I want to be a fireman. I want to play Major League Baseball. I said, what do you want to be? And he said, oh, I want to be a soldier. I said, well, don't just be a soldier, be a leader. Go to a service academy and, you know, be a leader of men. So 8 years passed. Hey, you know, we think nothing of it. And I had kind of helped him a little bit. Applying for schools and driven him up to different places, and he's all set. He's got a nice deal at Illinois College, like $50,000 scholarship. He's going to play baseball. I don't know if he either met or talked with the baseball coach there, and he's all ready to go. The people were so nice, you know, Division III program, far enough that he's away from home, but a small college. But so he's all set. He'd apply to some other schools, and it's like November. Okay, of his senior year, and he says, Dad, I want to go to a service academy. And I'm like, what, huh? And plus, November of your senior year, you can't get into a service academy. So we did the process, and who was it? Bill Kokas, the big Mizzou booster who I knew. I saw him at a Rams game as I was coming in. You know, we were both entering the stadium at the same time, and he said he knew some people, and that started the process, and he got in, and this is like 2006 is when he got in. He was a catcher and didn't play that much. Oakville, they had like three catchers ahead of him that all played college ball. So his timing was awful. And he probably could have started and played for a lot of the high school teams, but he didn't get much playing time. Anyway, Oakville High School, they're playing a game. He's taking batting practice, so he doesn't have his phone with him. He gets on the bus. He's got a message. And it was from, who was it that the former representative Callahan, Russ Callahan, was it from U.S. telling him you've received your appointment to West Point. So here's us on the bus driving to a game. And anyway, it's 06, but 9/11 is what inspired him that he wanted to join the military and go to West Point. And, you know, very, very kind of neat story. And, so he goes, and his brother, who would be 3 years behind him in school, he was kind of inspired by his older brother and said, I'm going to do that too. And so he was much more ahead of the game in terms of applying and everything. I think he knew even before his senior year started in high school that he had gotten the appointment. And so they actually overlap 1 year. Tim, the oldest, his first year, senior year, was the plebe year, a freshman year of the younger ones. So they were there together. I went up. in those years, I'd go up maybe 2-3 times a year. Sometimes in season, like if the Rams had a bye week, I'd go up and catch a football game and see the kids. Or I think there was one time that the Rams were playing New York, you know, at the Meadowlands, and it was only maybe an hour, hour and a half to drive up to West Point. So I came in a day early. A lot of fun. And then the number three son is the Rebel. Very, very good rock drummer. He was the band is now disbanded, called The Few. They used to play all the clubs, used to tour small clubs in the Midwest and the East. And I had people that I didn't know come up and say, hey, you know, your son's the best rock drummer or one of the best rock drummers in St. Louis. But alas, no one discovered him. So the band broke up a few months ago.
All right, so now two questions. One, for the first two, after they graduate, as a parent, I'd be a wreck.
Well, yeah. And the oldest son, Tim, he was in 8 years, and he's now just reserve duty. He's no longer active duty, captain, and he works for St. Louis Police Department in planning and research. So he's not a uniformed policeman. But he did it almost a year in Afghanistan. Now, most of the active combat that the U.S. was doing was done by then. He was basically on a base, kind of like I said, in kind of intelligence and research for the Army. But he'd send pictures back. And if he was at a bazaar or wherever he was at, I'm like, why do you always have that rifle strapped on your, you're just going to the bazaar? And his reply was, Dad, they're all trying to kill us over here. So that was kind of nerve-wracking. And now the middle son is still active duty. He's like in his fifth year, and he's over in Kuwait right now. And given the world situation, yeah, a little bit nervous.
So for the drummer, if it was me, Junior, you're allowed to drum from 3 to 3.
Actually, my wife, because the band would practice in our basement. They'd come over and practice twice a week in the basement. And that's about the only time I got a home-cooked meal, because my wife would cook for the band. She loved seeing the boys, but they had to be done by 9 o'clock, 9 p.m., and so that was fine. I remember one of our neighbors came, an older gentleman, and I wasn't there, but he came to my wife, and he said, and because my son would, he'd practice by himself a lot, maybe not every day, but almost every day. And he said, who is that playing the drums over at your house? And my wife, Paula, said, oh, that's our son. And he said, well, he's terrible. He needs lessons. So, but no one ever, the neighbors never really complained. Or again, because we were cut off by 9 p.m. So
stupid question, and then we'll wrap this up. If you're in the Army now and you're not in line with the president nowadays, you just keep your mouth shut, or how does that work?
At West Point, you're trained. Now, I'd be a liar to say if it was strictly enforced, but you're trained to be apolitical, because no matter how much of a knucklehead the president is, or you like him or don't like him or her, you just have to follow orders, and as long as they're moral orders. Like I asked the oldest son, well, when Trump called the West Pointers back in the middle of this COVID crisis, because he wanted some props for a speech, they had been home forever. So he called him back. I said, well, could you say no? He said, oh yeah, you could say no, but you'd get court-martialed, So they're taught to be apolitical, and, they all have strong political opinions. I will say this. I think there's a lot more liberals that are in the West Point and in the military than people would think. Not the majority, but more so. There are a lot of patriots that are liberal people.
So. All right. So when did you start covering Missouri? And Jim, you'll notice my logo doesn't say Mizzou. It says Missouri. When did you start covering Missouri?
1985, 86 season. I came right in with Woody's wagon. Woof! What an experience that was. And
they still Woody from the Oklahoma Outlaws of the USFL, and we thought this was a good idea.
Well, and he'd been part of all those Super Bowl championship teams with Pittsburgh Steelers. He was called one of the architects of the Iron Curtain. I think most of the credit probably should have gone to Bud Carson, but a good football mind, flashy. He was a Mizzou alum. He was a hell of a recruiter. I mean, he brought in some great recruits, fantastic recruits, but he had terrible luck with almost most of them. Tony Van Zandt arguably the greatest running back in St. Louis high school history out of Hazelwood Central. Maybe, you know, Ezekiel Elliott might put up an argument there, but he had, was it before his first season, there was a, it was called Lions Club. It was an all-star game for the top high school players in Jefferson City. He tears up his knee, Tony Van Zandt does, in this high school all-star game about a week before preseason camp started for Mizzou. He was never the same. I think he had maybe 200-something yards and one touchdown in his entire Mizzou career. Ronnie Cameron, quarterback from East St. Louis, he wasn't just a Parade All-American. He was Parade's National Player of the Year quarterback. He had some arm problems. He never panned out. And I could go on and on with the guys he recruited. The one that is the most kind of strangest one is Rob Dryden, St. Charles High, 6'8", about a 320, 330-pound offensive tackle. Barry Switzer was in his living room. Nebraska was all over him. He goes to Mizzou, and maybe about 2 years in, he just decides football isn't fun. I think he was scheduled to be a starter the coming season, and he quits and becomes a bass guitar player in like a band, you know, like a rock band or a blues band. And I actually went down to right when it happened, I went down, they were playing, his band was playing in St. Louis down on Laclede's Landing, back when Laclede's Landing was a thing. I think the place was called Lucius Boomers. Some people might remember that name. And there he was playing the world's largest bass guitarist at 6'8". Pretty good band too. They put on a pretty good show.
The Eclipse.
Yes. Very nice. You advanced to the lightning round with that.
You know, it's so hard to say Woodenhofer was going to be a good coach. But to his defense, 4 years, 3 ADs, and 2 chancellors. That doesn't help.
Oh, and a brutal schedule. Remember when Jack Langle, or maybe you don't, when he was AD, Mizzou was criticized because the schedules were watered down. But they, the Big Eight was just unbelievable back then. Oklahoma and Nebraska every year were in the top five. A bad year, they would be in the top 10. Colorado was just starting to emerge as a power under Bill McCartney. Maybe it was 2 years after Woody left was the fifth down game. And where they ended up actually sharing the national title with Georgia Tech. Oklahoma State was always very good. When the 6 years I covered Mizzou from 85 to 91, they had a couple of running backs. One was Thurman Thomas, then a guy named Barry Sanders followed him. So that was brutal. But Missouri was playing like Miami of Florida, you know, Jimmy Johnson back when they were at their high, maybe a little bit before Johnson. I think most of it was Jimmy Johnson. They played Houston when they had Andre Ware and were scoring like 80 million points a game. They played at the University of Texas. They schedule Indiana for like 8 years in a row. And you thought, oh, okay, Indiana, here's some wins. Well, it was the best stretch, not that it's a glorious, the best stretch of Indiana football ever under Bill Mallory. I think in 4 years, Indiana won like 32 games and made bowls like 3 times. It was the best stretch ever that they've had in history. So the schedule was brutal, and Woody could recruit. I think he underestimated how good the coaching was. And he admitted it. Woody could be very honest about stuff. I mean, after his first or second season, he said, he underestimated the quality of the coaching. I guess maybe he thought he'd come in, wave the Super Bowl rings around, and win some ball games. But, you know, when you're coaching against Tom Osborne and Bill McCartney and Barry Switzer, you know, and the football was bad, but it was historically bad, and that made for some unbelievable games like the Norman Conquest, you know, the 77-0 loss at Oklahoma. And the team was getting better. A lot of junior college recruits, and including Robert Del Pino. They were 5-6 his third year and just missed a couple games of maybe winning another game or two and would have got him in a bowl, even back then when there weren't as many bowl games. And then it just didn't work out the last year. They had a lot of injuries, another brutally tough schedule, and that was it for Woody.
OmniTurf did not help. Did you ever walk on that thing when it was wet?
Oh, yeah. Boy, lots of rubber if you'd run on it. But yeah, some very interesting games. Obviously, I was in the press box for the fifth down game. When you said running, I can remember. I could, because I knew how to get down to the locker room. I was not one of these guys, if I was familiar with the stadium, where late in the game, I'd go down, you know, go down to the field and watch the game end on the field because you're afraid you wouldn't make it to the locker room for the interviews in time. So I waited to the very end. By the time I got down there, I saw fans running, chasing the officiating crew. It was a little small, tiny officiating locker room. They were chasing him into the locker room on that OmniTurf there.
You mentioned the Norman Conquest. I got a good Woody story, but you can go first. Tell me your Woody story the night before the Norman Conquest.
Well, you know, I was younger then, so the Riders, we'd go out and eat, but, you know, have a few drinks. So it was around midnight, a little after midnight, and, you know, we stayed at the normally, and most of the Riders that traveled, including the ones at the Missourian and Tribune, we'd a lot of times stay at the same hotel as the team. So maybe it's quarter after 12, and I go up to the went up to my room, and then I always like to look at the newspaper, no internet back then, in the town, just to read a little bit about the team and what they were saying about the game. And I went up to bed, and I forgot to get a newspaper. So I go down to the lobby, get a newspaper out of the newspaper box, and the hotel bar was like an open lobby. And so it was like you could see it going up to your room, hotel bar. And Joe Castiglione, who's still the AD at Oklahoma now, was an assistant AD at Mizzou back then. He says, "Jim, come on in. We're having a couple of drinks. Why don't you have a nightcap?" So I go in there, several Mizzou people, and by that time, maybe it's quarter to one, and there's Woody. Woody looks at me and says, "Jim, you know, I don't do this all the time." And I'm like, "I don't care. I'm off duty. You know, as long as you don't burn down the place, I don't care what goes on." In my head, I'm thinking, you're playing Oklahoma, Barry Switzer, Oklahoma, Brian Bosworth. You remember the Boz, the one of the greatest college linebackers ever. Didn't amount to much in the NFL. In like 12 hours, I don't know what the start time was, 12 noon or 1 p.m. Back then, not many games were televised. You didn't have these games starting at all hours of the day and night. Joe Castiglione, bless his heart, who did great things, continues to do great things at Oklahoma. Castiglione says, "You know, I think if we hang tight early, this is going to be a heck of a game." And it was 48-0 at halftime. So. I believe it was Merv Johnson, but at halftime, an Oklahoma assistant, because Merv Johnson was, I think he was defensive coordinator maybe for the Sooners. But anyway, he's a former Mizzou assistant. I believe he played at Mizzou too. He's the suspect. Someone from the Oklahoma coaching staff sent a note to Mizzou at halftime, Mizzou trailing 48-0, saying, "You're in the wrong defense." Just trying to help him get lined up right. And Mizzou had so many injuries. They had Ray Lazalier, a great fullback linebacker at Wentzville High at the time. There was just one Wentzville High School back then. He was playing nose tackle against Oklahoma, which were I believe they did they I think they won the national title that year in 85. Usually, if you're a college linebacker, if you're a high school linebacker, maybe become a college safety. Usually, don't move up to heavier positions. So that was a tough game. The other big memory from that game is in the second half, the score is long, you know, it's long decided. And I did see on the opposite sideline, Brian Bosworth, shoulder pads off. It was just like a chain link fence separating the bench from the fans. He's leaning over the fence, shoulder pads off, eating a hot dog during this game. So that was the Norman Conquest.
So here's small world. I'm in Salt Lake City, right, Jim? And I'm running two all sports radio stations. There's like three bars in Salt Lake City at the time. So the one that's closest to my house, the place called Lumpy's, and the owner of the bar is Al. And so
Al from Lumpy's.
Al Lumpy's. So I'm watching Mizzou football. I'm watching Mizzou basketball. It's like the only time he sees me. So about 2 months into the job, he comes down, he sits himself down and introduces himself. He says, Al, I'm the owner. Are you a Missouri fan? And I'm like, yeah, a Big Tiger fan. Good and bad. He pulls out of his wallet this Polaroid of him in a Missouri parka, like when it used to rain and be really snowy. And he continues to tell the story that he was with some buddies, not a football fan, but just they were partying. They went up to the hotel room where the Missouri coaches were partying with people that they should not have been partying with. And at the end of the evening, one of the coaches, somebody, parks at the closet where all the Missouri official the outfitters were, and said, pick what you want. We're not going to need these.
Really? Now, what did he say? What game was this for? Or for, was this football? Was this for Woody? Woody's
well, he wasn't there to see the game. He was at the hotel partying.
Okay, so he could care less what was happening the next day. Okay.
Right.
But was it under Woody's tenure? Or
Yeah. It was like the end of Woody's tenure.
Pick what you want. That's pretty funny. Later, Switzer was in town for a game, and Woody had gotten I think it was 86, he'd gotten a DUI after a win over Kansas State, which was hardly worth celebrating back then. Remember how bad K-State was. And he and so Switzer was actually driving him around town. What's the all-night diner in Columbia? Do you remember that?
It's called the Diner, Broadway Diner.
Okay. They go in there, you know, it's not that late, but maybe it's like midnight, and they got behind the counter and were like cooking food back there. Could you imagine that? I didn't learn this story until 20 years after I'd left covering Mizzou, but making flapjacks, Barry Switzer and Woody Widenhoff or whatever they were making.
Your opinion, lack of administration, paying attention in the early 80s really hurt the program for a long time. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, no, it did, and a lot of other factors. Their facilities were just terrible back then, and I know because we'd go to all the other Big Eight towns, and we'd see what they had at Nebraska and Oklahoma, and you're trying to recruit kids, and a kid shows up and sees the, I don't know, let's just say the Nebraska weight room, and then he sees the Missouri weight room, all things being equal. Oh, I'm going to go to Nebraska. Now, it's totally different now. I mean, Mizzou really has upgraded their facilities, but the facilities, the revolving door among athletic directors and, you know, changing coaches left and right. And a lot of times in college football, once you fall down that slide, it's hard to get back up. It's hard to reverse it, especially – you know, there's no free agency. You don't have the kids for like 10 years, like an NFL career. You get them for 4 years. So it's hard to catch back up. And I think that might have been an age when they'd started establishing the scholarship limit. So you couldn't just, you know, sign 100 kids to a scholarship. So a lot of factors. It took them a while. You know, thank goodness Gary Pinkel showed up. Although Larry Smith did a lot of things too, you know, to help at least stop the bleeding.
So during this time, Missouri football, not so good. Missouri basketball, actually quite good.
And fantastic.
Norm Stewart at the helm.
Yeah, fantastic basketball. And it was showtime. The Big Eight was just tremendous back then. Billy Tubbs at Oklahoma. Johnny Orr, those games up at the Hilton Coliseum in Ames. They'd play the Tonight Show music when Johnny Orr would come out. Here's Johnny. And my God, going into, you know, Allen Fieldhouse and Mitch Richmond playing for K-State. I mean, oh, it was just – I remember their team that reached the – might have been the year Norm was sick – that reached the Sweet 16 and really came within a whisker. I think they lost to Syracuse in overtime of making the Final Four. I think you talk about a stack that was in Minneapolis, a stacked regional, had Mizzou, Illinois, which ended up going to the Final Four, Syracuse and Louisville. That was a Sweet 16 regional, but Nathan Bunton was like the eighth man or ninth man on that team, and he was like all freshman, you know, and this was like maybe his senior year or junior year, and they had brought in so many players that it was a lot of fun to watch.
You mentioned Mitch Richmond. Were you there when him and Chivas hit 9 three-pointers in a row?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I was. I was at all their games. The only game that I missed in Mizzou during that time was a Bush Bragging Rights game at the would have been the arena. And it was the night Tim, my first son that we talked about earlier, was born in 1987. So, oh, yeah. Yeah, Chivas and Mitch Richmond and Iowa State had Jeff Grayer. I mean, there were all kinds of, you know. I remember one of my last – was my last year? Maybe it was our second to last year on the beat. Mizzou had this pretty highly regarded guard from – he was Mr. Kentucky Basketball named Travis Ford. I remember covering that. And then after Mizzou went on probation, Ford played only that 1 year. He went and finished out his time at Kentucky. And lo and behold, what, 30-plus years later, here he is coaching St. Louis University, doing a great job. I've never gone over there to say to St. Louis U. I've you know, been to a couple games spectating or whatever, but never said hi to him. He probably wouldn't remember me, but it's just amazing that we've had the full circle of Travis Ford here in Missouri.
Well, and the only reason he went to Mizzou was because Kentucky was on probation. So Kentucky
goes. Is that right? I don't even remember that. Yeah. Okay. So yeah.
Kentucky goes on probation. He goes to Missouri. The Missouri goes on probation. Then he goes back to Kentucky.
And as you know, David, Travis Ford was like a 90% free throw shooter. So it just astounds me that the Billikens are so bad free throw shooting. I guess it's hard to, and I'm sure he's coached the hell out of them to improve their free throw shooting. But it's got to drive him nuts because he could. What are the Billikens average? Maybe 55, 57%, or maybe 60% of this team. He could probably, Travis Ford, even now, could probably hit 60% with his eyes shut at the free throw line.
Well, the thing that people forget about with Missouri basketball is it wasn't at a time where every game was on TV. And so for Norm, he had to go on the road to get himself on TV. I remember they went to Virginia. They played Ralph Sampson. I remember they went to Georgetown. If you remember the Georgetown thing, that was a fiasco. They had played on a Saturday. They had to go to Georgetown on a Sunday. Saturday night, Georgetown claims that there's, like, water flowing over in their showers, and they've got to go play in this 6,000-seat arena. So they're on national television against Patrick Ewing in the 6,000-seat. But Norm would do whatever he thought he needed to do to get the program some national exposure, and that's what he did. Do you remember in Vegas? We were at this game together, I think. When Tark had the locker rooms like at 90 degrees, and so yes, Norm yes. just said
was at the 86-87 season.
It was around there. Yeah.
No, the Ralph Sampson game in Georgetown, that was before my time now. But you're right. Back then, especially early 80s, now it was starting to change a little bit because I started the beat 85-86, but there weren't that many games on TV. Now, just about every game's on TV. And so, yeah, you had to hustle to get some national exposure.
We were both there in Columbia. 1989, the first nationally broadcast game from Columbia was Mizzou versus KU. Two things I remember. One is Mizzou won. And two is nationally televised game, all that media, and we're still eating two Domino's pizzas in that back office in the belly of the basement.
Well, not their job to take to feed the media.
Were you there the day Chivas and Sam Bodie got in a fight in practice?
I don't think so, because we saw very few practices. You know, I don't think the practices were open. And I would only, you know, being in St. Louis, and I didn't live in Columbia, you know, I would come up maybe, not counting games, maybe once a week to Mizzou for most of Norm's time, at least that I can remember when I was covering them. They'd have like a media day where you talk to Norm and they'd make a couple players available. So no, I didn't see that one.
Okay, you're absolutely right. It was a closed practice. And the reason we couldn't report on it was because we weren't supposed to be there. But this is Chivas' freshman year. And it's probably a month into the season, whatever the case.
So I know I didn't see it because my first year on the beat was Chivas' sophomore season.
Okay. So yeah. Chivas is from New York and he's got the New York swag. And Sam Bodie's from Washington.
Was he wearing the Band-Aid then?
Oh, 100%. And yeah. Sam Bodie's from Washington. And
Missouri.
And obviously for about a month, they had just been jabbing and not getting along. Back and forth. Mm-hmm. Norm blows a whistle, pulls everybody aside, takes Chivas and Sam Bodie at center court, and says, let's get this over with now. Chivas backs off. Sam Bodie does a throw punch, but from then they were really good friends. You can't do that kind of stuff anymore.
No. You know, Sam Bodie, players like him and Greg Church, they were such functional, doesn't give him enough justice. They were just really hard-nosed and good college players, you know, from rural areas. They overlapped a little bit too, if I recall.
I did.
You know, on the roster, yeah.
All right, so Jim, I'm going to tread lightly on this one. If you don't want to talk about it, that's fine. 88, the Post-Dispatch does a series about Rich Daley in Detroit and how out of nowhere Missouri's getting all these recruits now, great players, coming from Detroit. I wasn't there. I vaguely remember. You and Norm get into a thing. And kind of like at the end of the discussion, he threatens your kid. True?
Oh, yeah. I was there. True.
Did he ever apologize?
I don't know how much I want to get into it. What happened was, it was one of these media days. And I didn't have to write for the next day. So I told my wife, why don't we bring the kid and go up and I'll do my thing and we can get some lunch after it. So this, we're talking about Tim, the West Pointer, the Army captain. He was one, and we just happened to bump into Norm in the parking lot at Hearn Center. I was just getting out of the car and he might've been leaving for lunch. So we were there, you know, very early before practice, where we were just going to hang out there and before practice in the media day. And Norm seems, oh, yeah, this is the little fella, you know. And he's, oh, yeah, you know, he's all nice and everything. So then I'm sitting, my wife is sitting way up the opposite part way up in the nosebleed, just waiting. Because remember, you'd have, at Hearns, you would walk down to the court. And I'm sitting under one basket. And he came by and kept saying, why are you trying to hurt my family? Why are you trying to hurt my family? You know, he's complaining about the stories we were doing on the investigation. And he kept getting angrier and angrier. All of a sudden, he turned, and as he walked away, he says, well, you're trying to hurt my family. I know someone who can hurt your one-year-old or take care of your one-year-old. I'm saying, it's like you heard it and you didn't believe it. And I said, Norm, what are you saying? So anyway, that was that. I learned years later that there was actually a non-basketball playing member that was in the building. I had a witness way late. But it ended up, Sports Illustrated did a little thing about it. Remember the Dallas Morning News, I think the Columbia Tribune might have done something about it. And could you imagine if something like that happened in today's media? I mean, it would have been a national story.
I'm guessing you never apologized?
No.
Okay. Wrapping up Mizzou basketball, I say PJ Mays. You say?
Well, no, he was, that was Cincinnati, right? That was not a Detroit recruit.
Sunville recruited two people. He recruited Jamal Coleman, and he recruited this kid named PJ Mays, and they sent money through the mail.
Well, and the thing was, of all the Detroit stuff, that was kind of on the final report. It was the PJ Mays thing that really, if I recall right, and again, it was a long time ago, it was over 30 years ago. I think it was a PJ Mays thing that like kind of headlined the probation and the NCAA's investigative report.
Let's move on to the Rams. 21 years on the beat, never missed a game. 431 games, so much so that you had an office at Rams Park.
Well, they had the media room there, but I got the corner so I actually had two desks. You know, they'd have desks, and the two desks went in the corner, and I just set up shop there. Put a lot of pictures on the walls over the years. A few that I still have up here in my home office here, but a lot of time spent in that building, and I think that's probably why I was able to find out a lot of stuff. I mean, people would come up and down the stairs there. That coaches would frequently come up and down the stairs. Sometimes I'd get late night visits from Mike Martz. You know, a lot of times I'd be working there till 9 or 10 o'clock. A couple times Martz would come down and watch film with me. That was very interesting. And this was before everything was, heck, now you can subscribe to a service and get see the games film. But I told him I wanted to watch film, and he said, well, listen, I'll get someone who can show you how to set up our little film machine. You can go in the wide receivers room. Now you have to go at night after the players are out of there. And it was one night. I was about 9 o'clock. It was a Tuesday night, which is game plan night for the coaches. And I'm in there watching the tape thinking, boy, I really know a lot about football. Look at me watching this tape. Martz comes in there and for like a half hour, an hour, and just to see his mind, stuff that I'd never even think to look at, just going over everything. But anyway, he's getting, as he's going on, he sees this mistake and he gets a little aggravated. And then he sees maybe this mistake. He's getting a little more aggravated. Finally, he's just like explodes. And if someone had run the wrong route or Warner had made the wrong read. And it's just me and him at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night in the wide receivers room at Rams Park. And he's yelling and screaming. Finally, I couldn't help myself. I looked at him and said, Mike, you do know you won this game 34-0, you know? He was a perfectionist. If it was supposed to be a 10-yard out pattern, it better well be 10 yards. Not 9.5 yards, not 10 and two-thirds yards. It better be 10 yards. And it was quite fun, I should say, watching that game tape. I mean, he did it just a couple times. He'd come down. He was a guy that tried to get to know the media, kind of as individuals, more than any other coach I've been around. And so when he was criticized, and we all did, all criticized him after the Super Bowl 36, it hurt him even more because he had gotten to know a lot of the media, not just me, but just real, you know, pretty well. I mean, occasionally in the off season, he'd come over and like Arby Foster and myself would be there, and he'd say, "Come on, let's go get a good Mexican place over in St. Charles. Let's go get some food." So I never, and I got along great. Dick Vermeil was great, and other coaches have been great to work with, but never seen a guy that really, you know, it's tried to get to know you as much as Martz did. So it really, like I said, when he got criticized after the Super Bowl 36, it was never quite the same. Although Mike and I always got along really well, I still talk to him, a couple times a year, stay in touch. And don't get me wrong, Dick Vermeil was fantastic. Just he did so much to change the energy in that building. When they'd moved to St. Louis in 95, they were in the middle of 10-year stretch of losing football. It wasn't until game 3 of the 99 season they passed Cincinnati, and they beat Cincinnati to achieve this feat. They passed Cincinnati as the team having the worst record in the NFL. Cincinnati fell to last, and the Rams move up one spot to, I guess there were 31 teams in the league then. I think it was, before the Houston Texans, I think. Anyway, so, but Vermeil just changed to turn all that negative vibes into positive atmosphere. And he knew everybody's name. It just amazes me whether you were the vice president of the Rams or the night janitor, you know. Eddie, how you doing? How are the family, you know? So, yeah, tremendous guy.
What'd you think when you heard about the Marshall Faulk trade?
Again, it was a little different then because there really was no internet, although ESPN, they might have even been in the building. He just came over and told me. Like I said, I spent so many hours there, and there was no internet where I could rush and get the stuff out. I don't think we had internet in the 90, 98, 99 offseason. He just told me. It was a tremendous deal, and they sure didn't give up a lot for them. I know some people panned the trade because Faulk had knee problems. I think Bill Polian said, well, he's never going to last, you know, because of these knee issues. The fact was, Polian was kind of right. That Faulk had three tremendous seasons, three of the best all-purpose seasons the league's ever seen. He was all over 2,000 yards of rushing receiving all 3 years. And then the knee just gave out. And my theory is, as much as anything, any kind of perceived Martz Warner feud or Martz's ego going bad or Jay Zygmunt not being able to sign the guys, too many free agents leaving. When Faulk's knee gave out, the greatest show was never the same. He was the guy that really made it all go because you had to respect the run, and that set up the play action and the passing game. But it was, it's got to rate right up there with Brock, Rolio for Brock. I don't know what else. Maybe years from now we'll say the Ryan O'Reilly trade, you know, would rank right up there. But it was a tremendous trade, and for 3 years he was just fantastic. And I remember when he was voted into the Hall of Fame, just, and I hadn't watched his highlights in a while, just watching it, and it was breathtaking. And he had a little bit of Barry Sanders. I forgot how elusive he was, and I'm not saying he was as elusive as Barry Sanders, but he had more of that in than I remembered, just how fast he was in his prime. And again, that the ability to be both a receiver and a rusher, and such a smart player too. It's just such great vision. I mean, it's just a shame the greatest show didn't last as long as it did. But my gosh, what do we've already got? Bruce, Faulk, Warner, Pace, and we can count Aeneas Williams, Hall of Fame. He played 4 years here. He wasn't in the first Super Bowl team was he was in second. There's already five Hall of Famers. Torrey Holt, now it may take 10 years. Torrey Holt will make that six. And you know what? I wouldn't discount, and he spent only, I think, 4 years in St. Louis. I wouldn't discount London Fletcher getting in. So all that on one team. Bernie Miklas wrote it. I think it was the year that Martz was fired. He said, hey, you guys, be careful what you wish for. You may not realize what you just saw with the whole greatest show. And Bernie was right.
Did I get this right? Making the play as told to Jim Thomas?
Oh, I think that was the title. Didn't exactly make the bestseller list, but but Mike Jones wanted me to write a book on him. And it was a lot of fun to do. Now, that came right after the Super Bowl year. So normally you could decompress after the draft and the OTAs, and I'd get about 8 weeks off, all vacation, some comp time, and all but 2 weeks of that summer after the Ram stuff was done, I worked on that book, and I was by about midway through that 2000 season, just the cumulative effect, I was pretty much burnt to a crisp, toasted. But those offenses, even that 2000 team. Now keep in mind, it's the year after the Super Bowl. Martz's first year as head coach. Warner gets hurt. What, sixth game of the season in Kansas City, or maybe it was seventh game. But anyway, if he doesn't get hurt, they would have broke every record, offensive record, scoring record in history, because they were just cooking before he got hurt. And they had to score, you know, Mike Martz and Dick Vermeil, when Vermeil was there in 99, they take their foot off the gas, you know, once they were up. They didn't want to rub it in. But that defense had gotten old all of a sudden. Mike Jones had lost a step. Keith Lyle had lost a step. DeMarco Farr had knee problems. They were scoring, you know, 35, 40 points a game, but they were giving up like 30 points a game for a while. So they had to score all the points. That would have been the record-setting offensive season. And now, you know, you look back on everybody thought, especially that 99 season, nationally especially, you can't win with an offense like this, passing the ball. Just wait till they get into the playoffs. And now you look, and all the teams pass way more. They pass way more than those Rams did in 99 through 2001. That was really a precursor, those Martz offenses, and in 99 guided by Dick Vermeil, of what we see now. They were really ahead of their time.
So on your watch, the Rams have the worst five consecutive years of any team in NFL history.
15-65, but who's counting? That's an average. That's an average of over 5 years of 3-13. So I go to the Blues beat. And the writers, especially the veteran writers, some of the fans are like, they're almost waiting for bad stuff to happen in the game. And I'm thinking to these guys, what are you bitching about? 3-13 over 5 years, that would be like going 15-65. Okay, that's 80 games. I realize it's an 82-game season in hockey. But that'd be like going 15-65 5 years in a row. You don't know what it's like to suffer. The Blues before the Stanley Cup, they were kind of like Marty Schottenheimer and the Kansas City Chiefs. They'd go 10-6, maybe get knocked out in the first round of the playoffs. Was that Marty Ball, right? Wasn't that Marty Ball? That didn't seem so bad coming from where I was, from my perspective. And you know what? The first year or two, in a perverse sort of way, it was fun. Everybody loves a train wreck, right? Everybody loves, but it gets old after a while. And that got old. It got old.
When did you realize the Rams were leaving?
You know, pretty late in the game. I was naively and foolishly thought that the league was actually going to respect the relocation guidelines. And if you read the relocation guidelines, there's no way the Rams should have been allowed to leave. But then it was right around the time when Houston's owner came out and said, you know, they've got a pretty good plan there in St. Louis. I think we can work with this. And it was like right after that, Goodell and Eric Grubman, who was involved in the whole relocation process or evaluation process, they went to like a scorched earth policy where they just nuked everything about St. Louis. So that was like maybe December of 2015. I do remember my wife driving me Paula dropping me off at the airport to fly to Houston for the vote on the relocation. And I told her, when I got out of the car and to walk through the terminal, saying, when I come back, St. Louis isn't going to have a football team anymore. She kind of looked at me like, and you remember the first vote, the way the day went, the committee vote was 5-1, basically in favor of St. Louis, against the Kroenke plan there. That was stronger than I thought. I thought they might win the vote, but it wouldn't be 5-1. So that was encouraging. Then the first total vote came out, and it was much closer than maybe we thought. I don't know if it was like 19-12 or 19-13 or whatever. But still, there were enough people that were kind of against the whole Kroenke project that I thought, well, maybe it'll just be stalemate. And that's when Jerry Jones went into the meeting changed the vote, change people's minds. It was a crazy night. And we had two people there. David Hunter did a fantastic job really covering more of the relocation stuff than I did. He covered the main press conference. I was assigned, hang out in the lobby. The owners, as soon as the meetings were, the owners, any meeting, not just this meeting, they have their limos waiting and they head to the airport no matter what time of day and night and get on their private jets and go back home. And that was my job to get as many as the owners. And some great stuff from Shad Khan of Jacksonville, but especially Jerry Jones. And I remember some of the Dallas writers right after that saying, this is going to get Jerry Jones in the Hall of Fame. And I'm thinking to myself, because he helped tear a team out of a city, that this is the final step. This is like a good thing. Are you kidding me? But Jerry Jones made it happen as much as anybody.
Before we move on to good things with the Blues, 2014, you lost a good friend in Brian Burrow. I remember the story. It was quite eloquent. I remember feeling, boy, that must have been a lot of responsibility on your shoulders to try and make that right, and you made it right. What do you remember about the story?
Oh, my gosh. I remember being asked to do it because I knew him as well as anybody at the paper at that time. And I actually wrote it at home here and made calls at home. And it might've been a Friday when it happened. So it went out to Rams Park, but a very, very quick day at Rams Park, and crying, writing it just various times, just sobbing like a kid, and then calling some of his friends in the business and stuff. It was tough. That one really, really hit me hard. I mean, for a long time, and I still think about him. I've got, a press pass. I'm looking at right now, Brian Burwell from the Rams Park credential, season credential from 2004. What a great man, a tremendous writer. And I loved his kind of joie de vivre. He'd show up, always have a smile on his face. He just loved what he was doing. He loved training camp. He loved spring training. He loved sitting in the press box. He loved the camaraderie, writing stories. And, we'd kid him, he was one that, like Bernie as a columnist, would hit the hole, Brian would paint a picture, and, sometimes we'd kid him like, come on, get to the point. But he's just a tremendous human being. And it was tough losing him. And then not long after that, losing Joe Strauss. Now, I didn't know Joe as well because the baseball beat writer and the football beat writer, okay, we both work for the Post-Dispatch, but you may see each other three times a year or something, if we had like a staff-wide meeting or something. Now, I got to know him a little bit because in his final years, he was a columnist and he'd come out there, but those were a tough few years for the Post-Dispatch, I tell you.
August 2017, moving on to happier things, you get the Blues gig. Let me ask you a question. Same person, same paper, three beats. Is that as rare as I think it is?
Well, four if you count high school. And because I did the St. Charles Post for a little over 3 years, and then I did Maine. I was transferred downtown and did Maine high school sports. So I think if you're there long enough, it's not that unusual. Now, to be the Maine beat guy for Mizzou football, Blues, and Rams for three teams, I'm not sure if that's ever been done at the Post. I know I'm the only guy to cover a pro championship in two different sports in the Post-Dispatch because We had no football championship until the 99 Rams. We had no hockey championship until the 2019 Blues. And that just leaves the Cardinals and then the St. Louis Hawks. And the St. Louis Hawks won in, what was it, 1958. So, yeah, so I, as a beat guy, it's never been done. I'll actually tell you this. 87 World Series, now it was a loss to Minnesota. Or no, would that, no, that was 80. Was that 85?
85 was a loss to the Royals. 87 was the
87 loss. 87 was Minnesota. Anyway, I covered, was it two games or three games in Minnesota in the Homer Dome? So remember we talked about Tony Van Zandt scoring one college touchdown for Mizzou in his injury-plagued career? I missed that touchdown. It was at Iowa State because I was up doing like seventh sidebar at the Minnesota. I did the visitor's locker room. Those were my sidebars. So I did cover a little baseball.
What was it like in the late 80s to work at that building on Tucker? They just don't make buildings like that anymore.
No, and we still, you know, we still had it until just a few months ago. No, just a classic newspaper business. Now, it was kind of a hollow shell of itself at the end because we used to print the paper there and haven't printed the paper there in forever. And then just even the amount of people as we continued, you know, the department shrinking. It you could, in the end, if you went in there at night, you could maybe fire a cannon and not injure anybody. And now even our copy editing is farmed out. For the most part, it's done in Indiana. And boy, you go back to like the late 80s or even earlier, you know, when I was started out there as a copy boy. You'd go in there on deadline and there'd be just look like the old time newspaper movies, you know, Citizen Kane or they're just even the Watergate movie, you go, there'd just be a million people in there, chain smoking, typewriters, everything. My first stories, David, that I wrote were actually on typewriter. You know, my kids joke that, how were you able to type out those words on the stone tablets? Wasn't quite stone tablets, but typewriter, a lot of pressure. Not to, you know, to not to spell wrong. I use whiteout a few times. And then if you're on the road, like even my first year covering Mizzou, you'd send it in the old facsimile machine and send it down to the paper.
So you get the radio, you get the Blues gig. Don't know a lot about hockey. What was it like, just a week of slap shot marathon to kind of catch yourself up on the game?
I had no time to prepare because we're talking late August. I'm in there. Getting in the process of getting in, and I had already done my tour of training camps, which I'd done, and also had gone up to Canton. I forget, was that the year Warner got in? I think it was. And I'm in there. This is after that. I'm sending out in the process of sending out credentials for the games we'd covered. And I'd cover maybe in a 17-week season, maybe 10 games, a lot of Chiefs games, but head over to you know, Nashville once or twice, Indy. Maybe I'd be able to squeeze in a trip down to Dallas or something like that. And I'm in there sending out the credentials for like the first maybe 6 weeks of games. And I literally like a tap on the shoulder in the bullpen, and it was Roger Hensley telling me that Jeremy Rutherford was taking a job at the Athletic, and that you know, what did I think about being the hockey writer? And you know, when you're covering a beat, whether it's was football or Mizzou, you're locked in. Your whole life is that, you know. You don't know a whole lot about other sports other than the Blues. When I got the beat, I probably couldn't have named 40 NHL players, you know. And so you talk about a steep learning curve. And, you know, Jeremy Rutherford then wasn't working for us, but at Lou Cork with NHL.com, Jeff Gordon of our staff, but especially Tom Timmerman. Remember the old thing you'd say about your two-year-olds? The average two-year-old asks 4,000 questions a day. That was me to Timmerman and all these guys all the time. And, you know, you just had to go in and, you know, not pretend you knew something you didn't. And, you know, the first year was tough. The second year was better. And like I said, year three, now I'm probably know just enough to be dangerous. The people were, the Blues people have been great. The players in the front office, they've all been great to deal with, but it was a late career change. I'll tell you that. And a lot of fun. What a fast game. I would, even now, I'll the home games. I'll watch them and I'll go home. And a lot of times you're riding through. So you might be riding till 11:30 at night, midnight, and then, you know, half hour drive home. I live out in Oakville, but you're still kind of wound up the adrenaline from writing the story. So I turn on the replay, would be on by then on Fox Sports Midwest. And, maybe it'd be a period or a period and a half. And then I'd finally would just like fall asleep on the couch. But I remember, oh, that was a good game. Sorry, blah, blah, blah. And then I'd go home, watch a replay. I'm like, I didn't see that. Oh, look at this. I mean, just such a fast game. It's been a lot of fun covering.
I think like boxing, hockey is the biggest sport, or the sport which has the biggest difference between watching it on television and being there in person.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And the best thing about the TV is the replays. You can watch the replays and you can rewind them. You can watch the same play 10 times you want on TV. Now, as you know, at the Enterprise, you can see the replays. They have TV screens up, but you got a lot going on. You're keeping notes, so maybe you take a quick glance at the replay. But yeah, the sport, you're right. In person and the crowd reactions, it's all good. It's amazing.
So last January rolls around, and of course you're telling everybody, don't panic. Blues are going to have the best turnaround in the history of all sports.
No, I wasn't. No, I wasn't, David. I do in season. I do a Blues show, and it was just kind of a carryover from a Ram show, a radio show over at 550 KTRS. I remember sitting there with Brandon Wiese in December, and basically, I'm sure we could go back in the tapes and find it and just say, no, they're done. They're done. And I remember talking off air. This is like right before the Christmas break. Brandon and I talking about Brendan. Why am I calling him Brandon? Brendan. We're talking about, I guess we're going to really have to maybe concentrate more on the draft here as we get into January. And I'll admit it. I thought they were done. I thought they were toast. I mean, what, January 2nd, 3rd, you're dead last in the league in points.
So you mentioned the O'Reilly trade. At the time of the trade, did you have any Falk flashbacks?
No, not really, because although O'Reilly had a big name, he didn't have the reputation of a Falk. I mean, Falk was just known throughout the length and breadth of the NFL. I think he was runner-up for the Heisman Trophy, which is a pretty good feat considering he didn't play at Oklahoma or Michigan or Notre Dame. He came out of San Diego State. The interesting thing about that day is, one, the volume of moves that he made, Bozak, Perron, and then we thought they were done. We thought they were done and for the day, because they had had a press conference at maybe 1 o'clock talking about those guys. And I think maybe Hutton had signed with Buffalo. I think I'm remembering there. So, okay, that's a wrap. We'll go. Then all of a sudden it's like 8 o'clock at night. And, we'd ask Armstrong about the trade and he O'Reilly, is that going to happen? And he didn't seem all that confident then, but then, like 6-7 hours later, there's the O'Reilly, and we're like, wow, this could be something. But yeah, I didn't. That's a good question, but I didn't really equate it with Falk at that time.
So keeping things unfairly simple when it comes to the season, I think two things are important. One is the coaching change. Your thoughts?
Yep. Oh no, you're exactly right. And he helped change the culture and help get them all on the same page. Plus, a lot of the younger players. He had the advantage, the Vince Dunns, even the Bennington, the Sammy Blaze, Ivan Barbashev, but Ruby coached them all with the Chicago Wolves. So he knew them. He already had established reputations as a head coach player. So they knew what to expect, and they knew what a hard driver. So, yeah, no, that was a huge move. And nothing against Mike Yeo. Remember, the year before, Yeo had done a great job. Well, 2 years before, the year before I got on the beat, taking over for Hitchcock and leading him down the stretch and in the second round of the playoffs, but it just wasn't working for Yeo in 2018-19. I remember they had lost to the then last place Kings 2-0. I believe it was November 18th. I'm like 2/3 done with my game story. It was like 11 o'clock or something like that. By the time the Blues, they didn't wait till the next day. They just announced that he's out of there. And so that was a interesting night. But, yeah, no doubt about it that getting Berube was the big thing. And I think I know what you're going to say for the second thing, but go ahead.
You finally got a goalie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's the closest thing in terms of an out of nowhere thing. And I did make this connection once Binnington started turning the league on its head to Kurt Warner. Now, not quite the totally out of nowhere story as Kurt Warner, but come on. This was a guy who you didn't even have room for in the AHL, and he didn't want to go to the ECHL, which is like double-A baseball. He didn't want to go down to the ECHL. So that's how he ended up. You remember, he ended up playing for Providence, the Bruins. The Bruins AHL team, and a year later he's in the Stanley Cup, and few of the Bruins are guys that were teammates for him in Providence. But for a guy that was, what, fourth goalie on the depth chart till middle of the season, he played pretty well in the preseason, but that season before he started starting, he was called up earlier, and he came off the bench a couple times when Jake Allen struggled, and there was nothing special about him. You know, he gave up like 2-3 goals. Then he comes up, what was it, January 7th, January 8th against Philadelphia. It was really amazing. I do remember, because as a post-dispatch, you know, you're there every day, myself, Tom Timmerman, Gordon, whoever else, columnist there. You try to sweep up every crumb. I remember talking to him in training camp that year, and he hardly had anything to say. You can tell he was just so intense, and I'm like, man, this guy's got a chip on his shoulder, you know? You know, was it about being, you know, overlooked, sent down to Providence and or asked to go to the ECHL, and he turned that chip into something really good, right? Historic.
How are you doing on your Jordan Binnington top 10 quote list?
You know, boy, you have done your research for this interview. I've got, let me see, I don't know if this will show up here. I've got 7 written down on this piece of paper, not the entire quotes, but, and it reached the point where I told him I was doing this, and he kind of laughed. I said, you'd been a little more low-key this year, Jordan, so I don't know if I'm going to get to 10. You know, I may have even joked, you got to pick up your game a little bit, but because I think he's maybe matured a little bit. But then came the All-Star game, and he said some crazy stuff there. I think I have 10 now, but you know, the pandemic struck, so I haven't run it. Maybe it's worth dusting off if we do get to the playoffs this year, because I do think I have 10 now.
So as we wrap up the Blues and get ready to wrap this up, first of all, again, Jim, thanks for your time. I've had a ball. As a guy who likes hockey but doesn't live and breathe it, it seemed to me the Blues last year from January on scored the most goals in the first 2 minutes of a period and the last 2 minutes of a period. And that if you looked at how many goals from January through the playoffs, they were scoring to start and scoring to end, my non-educated opinion would have been they were way ahead of the second best team.
You know what? The beat writers got to do some homework on this, because I couldn't tell you. I wish I had the numbers off the top of my head, but they did have some comeback wins, certainly down the stretch, and some late goals. For the longest time, I think they were unbeaten when they scored first, and that trend kind of held this year. So, what I remember most about that run, one with the Binnington phenomenon, but just that road trip when they came out of the All-Star break, and they started out in Columbus, and then they played Florida, and that was the part of the dad's trip, and that's where we first discovered the Gloria song. I was the only media, not that wasn't with the club, like the Blues media, but I go down in the locker room after they rally from 2 to win in Florida, and they're playing Gloria, and I look at Vince Dunn, and you guys have a big win on the road, and you're playing disco music, you know, and he just laughed. Now, you could, if you're a music purist, is that really disco music? It came out in 82, I think. That's right when disco was dead, and it was like more called dance music in the 80s. But anyway, and then you go to Tampa. Again, that's still the dad's trip, and Tampa was, you know, lights out, and you won in overtime, Braden Shen, and just seeing that happen and just seeing the team, it was amazing. Just an amazing thing. And again, parallels to the 99 season, the Rams, remember the 99 Rams, went from worst to first because they were 4-12 the year before. And but the Blues did it worst to first in the period of one season. So it was – but there are parallels between the – like I said, the goalie coming out of nowhere and also the – just how the worst to first thing. It was fantastic to experience that.
So as we're getting ready to defend the Cup, I on purpose haven't really reached out to local beat writers, sports writers, because I didn't want to do an hour on COVID. But now that we've got dates on calendars and we've got things to talk about, a couple quick COVID questions. First and foremost, how did it affect you and your job?
Well, it was really eerie being in Anaheim because that's the night. It's in the middle of, we're in the middle of the game. Remember, it's a West Coast game in Anaheim when the news came out that the Utah Jazz player had tested positive. Right then you knew. And I think, did the NBA announce right then they were shutting it down? I'm not sure. Pretty close, yeah. But you knew right then, okay, boy, this is really serious. And that was the second game. The first one was a home game where media weren't allowed in the locker rooms. On the road, they had like a makeshift podium. And I remember young Dan O'Neill, one of the Blues PR guys, he marked off six steps. And then he put like a little rope and we had to stay behind there and the players and they, instead of going in the locker room, they'd bring the players out. And, but just the whole eerie thing of that night. And it was eerie going into that building because remember that was a makeup game for the Jay Bouwmeester collapse, cardiac arrest that happened exactly a month earlier, February 11th. Now we're here March 11th. And so you're down there like waiting outside the locker room for like after the morning skate for interviews. And you're thinking back to February 11th when it was part of the dad's trip. Talk about a total opposite of 2 years dad's trip. All the dads are down there after they cancel the game in the hallways with their son's jerseys on. And they're just worried to death about waiting to see after Bouwmeester had been hauled off in the ambulance, if he was going to live or what was going on. So just the total contrast. And then, the post, we fly with the Blues charter, at least regular season, not postseason. And, you know, we pay for the flights, but John Kelly right behind me and then finding out, what was it, a week, 2 weeks later, that he had COVID-19 and was pretty sick and wondering. Jesus, I always sit right in front of him. So he's like, if he's coughing, he's like 2 feet away. So that was a concern. And also learning that even before we knew about John Kelly, that the Ottawa Senators had been in the visitors' locker room at Anaheim at the Honda Center 12 hours before the Blues were there for the morning skate. And like about a week after the play was paused for COVID-19, it came out that three Senators had tested positive, you know, and you're worried, God, I was in that, at least in the hallways outside the locker room, the Blues were in the locker room, but nothing happened there. They were all okay. So those were the close shaves, I guess, in hockey with COVID-19.
Is the league telling you anything about what to expect for the season and the playoffs?
Well, in terms of our access, like the small group workouts start Monday, the 22nd, and media's not allowed in the building. And so I don't know what the access will be. Maybe there'll be some Zoom calls or something with the players. Nothing has yet been established for the start of training camp. I don't even know that we're going to be allowed to be in the buildings for the hub cities. This is all a great unknown. Remember, they're limiting the travel party for the once they go to the hub cities, 50 each team can bring 50, just 50 players. Now, consider they're going to have expanded rosters. The Blues will have, I believe, 32 players. They'll have 28 skaters and 4 goalies. They have 6 members of the coaching staff. They have 6 members of their combination of equipment staff, strength and conditioning staff, and training staff. That's 32 players. That's 44 right there. They have to have at least one PR guy, even if we're not there. Network TV is going to be there. And, you know, you'd think the general manager and the owner right there, that's almost 50 right there. So I don't know. I don't know if we'll even be in the building, or if we're in the building, I don't think we'll be allowed to be on the event center, you know, at ice level locker room.
As of right now, nobody's hurt. Nobody's been traded, banged up. Give me your top 4 possible Cup contenders.
Well, it's so tight. The league is so tight. And I found even more than the NFL. I mean, these leagues try to breed competitive balance to make it more interesting for everybody and unpredictable. And as competitively balanced as I thought the NFL was, the NHL even more so. And so many games are just, that's why I try to avoid using the term a blown lead. I mean, the puck can take just the funniest of bounces and all of a sudden it's you could be playing your rear ends off and all of a sudden a 2-0 lead disappears or whatever. So it's so tight. And I think it's going to be more unpredictable because everybody's starting fresh. Everybody will be healthy. Maybe there are one or two teams or one or two players that a team had that are out for the season. Like obviously Bouwmeester won't be back out there, but for the most part, everybody's going to have their top guys, fresh legs. And you know what? I think once you start in a season, and if you're a team that's kind of struggling, if you do it enough, that kind of becomes you. You say, well, this is just what we are, when it doesn't have to be that way. But so now the playoffs are going to start. Everybody's got a fresh slate. So I think this will be more unpredictable even than regular playoffs. And by saying that, last year, remember, every top seed in the four divisions out in the first round. So, but based on what happened before, I would have to say, and that's going to be like over 4 months old by the time they get on the ice, if they do, if we get to the start of play in early August, Colorado, Vegas, and the Blues, I would say, in the West and in the East, it's got to be Tampa, Boston, and, you know, I think you got to – just with Ovechkin, you got to throw Washington in there. I would have to say I would think maybe Colorado would be the favorite in the West just because how they were coming on. They were winning games with a lot of guys hurt, and maybe not hurt where they were going to be out forever, but, you know, McKinnon's back. Rantanen's back. Landeskog, I think, has been back for a while, and they beat up on the Blues pretty good the last two times they played. I think it was 5-2 and 7-3. Well, those were both up in the Stan Kroenke Center there in Colorado. But, I like the Blues' chance against Vegas. They had a couple tough overtime losses against Vegas. But, you know, David, Las Vegas has never beaten the Blues in a regulation game. And I know it's only, what, it's third year of Vegas? Yeah, third year. But they've never, you know, I think the Blues – have pretty good, maybe mentally, though they feel pretty good playing Vegas. But Colorado, God, that would hurt a lot of fans to see Stan Kroenke's team like knocking out the Blues in the Western Conference Finals. You know, that might hurt a little bit. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but they're a dangerous team. I got to say, David, this is the most prepared I've ever been interviewed on one of these podcasts. I tip my or no, I guess in hockey, I'd give you a stick tap there. Yeah.
It was good catching up. We haven't seen each other for too long. Right back at you. You made my job easy today. I appreciate your time.
A lot of fun. A lot of fun.
All right. There you have it. Another one for the books. The great Jim Thomas. Thanks for your time, guys. Appreciate. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you for telling friends. Thank you for making this a really fun ride. And as we do, thanks for your time, this time, till next time, so long.